It must be understood that it was not here only a question of overcoming natural disgust for the filthy liquid, but of being defiled according to the religious Hindu law. At that time, 10th century AD, Buddhism had already greatly degenerated, reverting to a number of Hindu superstitions strongly condemned by the Buddha. Nevertheless, while his companions hesitated, the Brahmin Naropa ran forward and drank the foul beverage. Another test was still more cruel. Master and disciple lived at that time in a hut, near a forest. Once, returning from the village with Tilopa's meal, Naropa saw that during his absence, the latter had fabricated a number of long wooden needles and hardened them in the fire. Greatly astonished, he inquired about the use Tilopa meant to make of these implements. The yogin smiled queerly. "Could you," he asked, "bear some pain if it pleased me?" Naropa answered that he belonged entirely to him and that he could do whatever he liked with him. "Well," replied Tilopa, "stretch out your hand." And when Naropa had obeyed, he thrust one of the needles under each of the nails of one hand, did the same to the other, and finished with the toes. Then he pushed the tortured Naropa into the hut, commanded him to wait there till he returned, closed the door, and went away. Several days elapsed before he came back. He found Naropa seated on the ground, the needles still in his flesh. "What did you think while alone?" inquired Tilopa. "Have you not come to believe that I am a cruel master and that you had better leave me? I have been thinking of the dreadful life of torments which will be mine in the purgatories if I do not succeed, by your grace, in becoming enlightened in the mystic doctrine, and so escaping a new rebirth," answered Naropa. As years went by, Naropa threw himself down from the roof of a house, crossed a blazing fire and performed a number of other fantastic feats which often put his life in jeopardy. To conclude, I shall relate one more of these curious tests, the story being rather amusing. Master and disciple were strolling in the streets when they happened to meet a wedding procession accompanying a bride to her husband's house. "I desire that woman," said Tilopa to Naropa. "Go, bring her to me." He had scarcely finished speaking before Naropa joined the cortege. Seeing that he was a Brahmin, the men of the wedding party allowed him to approach the bride, thinking that he meant to bless her. But when they saw that he took her in his arms and intended to carry her away, they seized on everything they could find, the palanquins' sticks, the torches that lighted the way of the procession and other implements, to belabor poor Naropa. So soundly was he cudgeled that he fainted and was left for dead on the spot. Tilopa had not waited for the end of the performance to pass quietly on his way. When he came to his senses again and had painfully dragged himself along until he overtook his whimsical guru, the latter, as welcome, asked him once more the usual question. "Do you not regret?" And, as usual also, Naropa protested that 1,000 deaths seemed to him but a trifle to purchase the privilege of being his disciple. At last, Naropa got the reward of his long tribulations, but not in the form of regular teaching and initiation. If we trust the tradition, Tilopa seems to have used, on that occasion, a queer method somewhat akin to that patronized by the Chinese teachers of the Tsan sect. There is no doubt that, though left apparently untaught, Naropa had been able to grasp a number of points in the Short Path's doctrine, during his lively period of probation. However, the manner of his full enlightening is related as follows. Naropa was seated near a fire in the open with his master. Quite unexpectedly, the latter took off one of his shoes and soundly slapped the disciple's face with it. Naropa saw all the stars of heaven, and at the same time the inner meaning of the Short Path's doctrine flashed into his mind. Naropa had later on a large number of disciples, and, according to the tradition, was a most kind master, sparing his pupils the painful ordeals which he had himself so bitterly experienced. Already advanced in age, he left the monastery of which he was a reputed doctor and, retiring in solitude, devoted 12 consecutive years to uninterrupted contemplation. He is said to have finally reached the excellent success. That is to say Buddhahood. Naropa is especially known in Tibet as the spiritual teacher of the Lama Marpa, who was himself the master of the famous ascetic poet Mylarspa, whose religious songs are most popular all over Tibet. If Naropa showed himself a mild spiritual father, such was not the case with Marpa, who tortured the poor Mylarspa for years, commanding him to build a house unaided and then ordering him several times to pull it down when nearly finished, and rebuild it again. Mylarspa was to dig out the stones alone and to carry them on his back. The repeated rubbing of these hard loads caused sores which became infected on account of the earth and dirt that entered them. Marpa pretended to ignore the martyrdom which his disciple endured. When, at last, yielding to the supplications of his wife Dagmidma, Marpa, who lived before the reform of Tsongkhapa, was a married lama. 141 The lama condescended to look at the bleeding back of Mylarspa. He coldly advised him to place a piece of felt on it with holes to isolate the sores. This is a process commonly used in Tibet for the sore backs of pack animals. The house built by Mylarspa still exists in Lobrag, southern Tibet. Tibetans do not entertain the least doubt regarding the complete authenticity of such stories. If we cannot vie in faith with them, we must, however, beware of considering all traditional account of the novice Nalgyorpa's exertions as mere fictions. It would be also an error to believe that such facts belong to a remote past and cannot occur again nowadays. The Tibetan mind has not changed since the time of Marpa. In the house of many lamas I have recognized the very picture of his home and customs, as they are depicted in Tibetan literature, while Marpa himself appeared to me personified by the master of the house. The young monk in quest of a spiritual guide has also remained the image of his predecessors. If not quite equal in zeal to Naropa and Mylarspa, who have been, in all times, exceptional characters, he is still ready to bear uncommon hardship, make a number of sacrifices and see many prodigies. And so the fantastic adventures of Yura are lived over again every day at the four corners of the land of snows. However barbarous the physical ordeals with which the hermits think useful to test the quality of their disciples may appear, these are, nevertheless, the lightest part of the training. The really dreadful trial is the purely mental one. This begins when the first idea arises in the candidate for initiation of begging the guidance of a mystic anchorite. So many things are rumored about these Gomjans, their life is so mysterious, their appearance and the rare words they utter are so exceedingly strange that, for Tibetans already inclined to superstitious terror, they seem a thousand times more to be feared than gods and demons. Indeed, they must be so, for they are credited with the power of enslaving gods and demons. Lost travelers or hunters have more than once related that while wandering across solitary hills they have had a glimpse of inhuman beings attending on some of these hermits. To betake oneself to such a master, to put one's present life and one's fate hereafter in his hands is a hazardous step. It is easy to imagine the hesitations, the conflicting feelings, and the anguish which prey on the mind of the aspirant to secret lore. The long distances which the candidate generally has to travel through desert regions to reach the hermitage of the master whom he has chosen, the wild majesty of the site in which such hermitages are generally situated, all these again contribute to deeply impress the young monk. Psychic training undertaken in such a disposition, in such surroundings, and under such a master cannot help being fantastic. Around the disciple abandoned to prolonged solitary meditations, heaven and earth quake and whirl so that he can nowhere find a firm footing. Gods and demons mock him with visions at first appalling, then ironical and disconcerting when he has conquered fear. The maddening succession of impossible occurrences may continue 10 or 20 years. It may torture the disciple until his death, unless, one day, he awakes from the nightmare, having understood that which was to be understood, and, bowing at the feet of his impassive master, takes leave of him without asking for any more teaching. Among several stories which I have heard from anchorites and Nalgyorpas, regarding their initiation, the following is typically Tibetan. When he betook himself to a Lama Gomchen, Yeshes Jayatso was not quite a novice in mystic training. He had spent several fairly long periods in strict seclusion, endeavoring to find an answer to a question which puzzled him painfully. What is the mind? he asked himself, and he tried to catch his mind in order to examine and analyze it. But the fugitive thing, as the water that a child endeavors to keep in its closed hand, always escaped. His guru, a lama from the monastery to which Yeshas belonged, seeing him tortured by his unsuccessful efforts, directed him to an anchorite whom he knew. The journey was not very long. Only about 3 weeks, which is reckoned a short time in Tibet, but the track went across desert regions and passes 18,000 feet high. Yeshas started, carrying on his back a few books, a blanket and the usual provisions, roast barley flour, butter and tea. It was in the second month of the Tibetan year. 142. In March, Tibetan New Year, Lhosa, fell early in February. Deep snow covered the ground and all along his way the traveler could behold those awe-inspiring frozen landscapes of the high summits which seemed to belong to another world. One evening, at sunset, he reached the Gomchen Hermitage, a vast cave, in front of which extended a small natural terrace that had been enclosed by a wall. Some distance below, a few huts sheltered those disciples who, for a short time, were allowed to stay near the lama. The anchorites' dwellings stood on the upper heights of a mountain formed by blackish rocks, commanding a view of the emerald green water of a small rippleless lake. I arrived there once, at dusk, as Yeshas had done many years before, and looking at the desolate scenery lighted by the dim twilight, I could understand how strong an impression it had made on him. Yeshas asked one of the lama's disciples to beg for him the permission to be admitted to his master. The Gomchen did not allow him to climb to his cave. This is habitual and did not astonish Yeshas, who had never expected to be received immediately. He shared the cell of a novice and waited. After a week had elapsed, he timidly ventured to have the hermit reminded of his request. The answer came at once. He was ordered to leave the place immediately and to return to his monastery. He cried out his despair to the eyrie of the teacher, and prostrated himself at the foot of the rocky slope. But no compassionate answer broke the dead silence of the desert. Yeshas had to go. The same evening, a hailstorm swept across a barren tableland which he had to cross. He distinctly saw giant threatening phantoms, lost his way in the darkness and was wandering about all the night. The following days brought nothing but trouble. The weather remained awful, the traveler had exhausted his provisions, he was nearly drowned in crossing a mountain stream and reached his gompa, at last, a victim of disease and despair. Yet, the faith which he had intuitively put in the stern Gomchen remained unshaken. 3 months later he started again. As during his previous journey, he met terrible storms on the high passes. The credulous Yeshas did not fail to ascribe them to supernormal cause. Either, he thought, the lama had let the winds loose to test his steadiness of purpose, or evil spirits had stirred them up to prevent him from reaching the Gomchen's hermitage and being initiated by him in the mystic doctrine. That second journey did not prove more successful than the first one. Yeshas was not even allowed to bow at the feet of the hermit, but was sent back immediately. He made 2 more journeys to the anchorite during the next year and the second time he was at last admitted before him. "You are mad, my son," the Gomchen told him. "Why are you so obstinate? I do not accept new disciples. I have also got some information about you. You have already pursued philosophic study and spent a long time in meditation. What do you hope for, from an old, ignorant man? If you really wish to learn the secret mystic law, go to the Lama Wen at Lhasa. He is conversant with all works of the more learned authors and is fully initiated in the esoteric traditions. Such a master is just what a young well-read man like you needs." Yeshas knew that this way of speaking is usual with gurus. It is a way of testing the degree of confidence and esteem in which the candidate disciples hold them. Moreover, he was full of faith. So he remained obstinate, testified in various manners of his sincere devotion and earnestness, and was finally accepted by the Lama. Another monk whom I have known had sought an anchorite teacher for reasons that had nothing to do with philosophic or mystic pursuits. If I relate his case, it is because it contrasts with that of Yeshas and shows another aspect of the Tibetan mind. Commodore G was low born. As a little boy, in the monastery where he was a jayok, which is a young novice of poor parentage whose family cannot maintain him, and who does menial work at a lama's house for his living. He had been the butt of ridicule and contempt of the young novices of his age who belonged to a higher social class. These vexations had embittered his young mind, and he confessed to me that he was but a little over his 10th year when he had sworn that he would rise above those who humiliated him. When he was grown up, his companions had at last to refrain from too open manifestations of their scorn, but they revealed it clearly enough by their silence and their aloofness. Commodore G was proud and possessed a strong will. He still dreamed of keeping the oath taken in his early youth. His low birth and his monastic condition left him only one way of reaching his aim. He must become a famous Naljorpa, a magician, one of those who coerce the demons and make them their retainers. In this way he could revenge himself on his tormentors and make them tremble before him. In this not very pious frame of mind, Commodore applied to the head of his monastery for a 2 years' leave, being desirous, he said, to retire to the forest for meditation. Permission he knew is never refused to such requests. Karma climbed high up on the hills, found a convenient place near a spring and built a hut there with branches and mud. Immediately, in order to imitate the Reskyangpas, 144. The Naljorpas who have acquired the power of developing tamo, the internal heat, and wear but a single cotton dress, Reskyang, or even remain naked. He discarded all clothes and let his hair grow. Those who brought him supplies of food at long intervals found him seated cross-legged and naked even in the heart of winter, apparently sunk in a deep trance. People began to talk about him, but he was still far from the fame he desired. He realized that his hermitage in the forest and his nakedness were not sufficient to obtain it for him. So he went down to his monastery, and this time asked permission to leave the country in search of a spiritual teacher. No one endeavored to detain him. Karma's peregrinations were much more fertile in incidents than those of Yashis, for the latter at least knew where he was going and under which lama he wished to practice the mystic life, while Karma had no idea of either and tramped at random. After a time, as he did not succeed in discovering a magician whom he thought capable of leading him to the topmost heights of the secret lore, he resolved to seek one by an occult process. Karma was a staunch believer in gods and demons. He knew by heart the story of Mylarspa who, with their help, had caused a house to fall down on his enemies, and remembered many other tales of terrible deities who brought the bloody heads which he had claimed into the middle of the Kayakha. 145. Magic diagram. Tibetan climate greatly differs from that of India, and if unclad ascetics, or pseudo-ascetics, are legion in the latter country, it is not so on the heights of the land of snows. There, only a very few Naljorpas adopt that simple fashion, and as they live far away from all tracks, in the recesses of wild mountains, one has few opportunities of catching a glimpse of them. 145. Constructed by the magician. He had acquired himself a certain knowledge regarding kayak whores. So he drew one with stones in an arrow gorge and began his conjurations in hopes that the mighty wrathful Lord's Towers would direct him to one of the masters whom they serve. In the course of the seventh night, a mountain stream that flowed in the gorge suddenly rose with startling rapidity. An enormous quantity of water, probably due to the breaking of a natural dam or to a cloudburst higher up the hill, dash suddenly swept across the defile, and the young monk was swept away with his kayakha and his small luggage. Whirled along amongst the rocks, Karma was lucky enough to escape being drowned and came aground at the end of the gorge in an immense valley. When day broke he saw at a distance, Aritoti 146. Hermitage 146 that stood sheltered by a rocky wall on the spur of a mountain range. The sun rose bright as it does on the tableland of Central Asia, and the little whitewashed house appeared rosy and luminous under its first touch. Karma could clearly discern the rays of light that flashed from it and rested on his head. Certainly his long-sought-for master lived there. The help of the deities answering his summons was not to be doubted. He had intended to walk up the gorge and to cross the mountain range, but they had brought him down to the Ritod. The intervention had manifested itself in a somewhat rough way, Karma admitted, but he ascribed this to a cause that could not but flatter his vanity. The Towos, he thought, have not been able to resist the strength of my conjuration, but foreseeing what a powerful magician I shall become, after I have received proper teaching, felt angered at the idea of eventually becoming my slaves. Rejoicing in his glorious future, Karma did not give a thought to the loss of the provisions and clothes that had been carried away by the flood. And as he had stripped himself of all garments, to resemble Haruka 147. A deity represented as a naked ascetic. 147. When officiating before his Kayaka, he now confidently marched toward the hermitage in a state of nature. As he neared it, a disciple of the anchorite came down to fetch water at a stream. The tripper almost let fall the bucket he carried when he caught sight of the strange apparition. "Who lives in that retod?" inquired Karma. "My master, the Jesses 148. A high graduate monk scholar." 148. "Tobs Jais," answered the tripper. The aspirant magician did not put a second question. What information did he now require? He knew all that he needed to know. The deities had led him to his very Tsawar Lama, means the spiritual guide. "Tell the Lama that they have brought him a disciple," said the naked traveler. Quite bewildered, the water carrier reported his words to the hermit, who commanded him to show in the strange visitor. Lama Tobs Jais was a well-read man, the grandson of a Chinese official and of his Tibetan wife. According to Karma's account, he appears to me to have been a gentle agnostic, who had perhaps adopted a hermit's life by the desire to study without being disturbed by troublesome people and by an aristocratic taste for solitude. This is rather frequent in Tibet. In fact, Karma really knew very little about his guru. As we shall learn, by his own story, he did not see much of him, and the few particulars he could tell me about his parentage and character he had learned from two disciples of the Lama who were inmates of the retod. In situation Kushong Tops Jai's hermitage followed the rule set down in Buddhist scriptures, not too near to a village, not too far from a village. From his small window the anchorite saw a wide uninhabited valley. While crossing the hill on which his dwelling was built, was a hamlet, at a distance of half a day's march. The hermitage was furnished with an ascetic simplicity, but a large library and some beautiful scrolls of painting on the walls showed that the hermit was neither poor nor ignorant of art. As Karma Dorji, a tall athletic fellow, clad only in his long plaited hair, stood before the thin refined scholar he has described to me, they must have formed a curious picture. After having prostrated himself with the utmost fervor before the Lama, he once more announced himself as a disciple brought by the deities to the very feet of the Master. The Lama allowed him to relate the story of the Kayaka, the miraculous flood and so on, without interruption. Then, as Karma once more repeated that he had been brought to his feet, Kushong Tops Jais remarked simply that the place where the water had carried him was rather far from them. Then he inquired the reason of his wearing no clothes. When Karma, full of his own importance, had mentioned Haruka and the 2 years which he had spent naked in the forest, the hermit looked at him silently for a while, then, calling one of his attendants, he said calmly, "Take that poor man into the kitchen that he may sit near the fire and drink very hot tea. Find him also an old fur robe and give it to him. He has been shivering for 2 years," and with these words he bid him leave. The flaming fire, the generously buttered hot tea refreshed him agreeably after his nocturnal bath. Yet his physical comfort was diminished by the mortification of his pride. The Lama, he thought, had not welcomed him as he ought to have welcomed a disciple brought to him miraculously. However, he intended, after having satisfied his hunger and taken a little rest, to make the Gomchen understand who he was and what he expected from a teacher. But Kushong Tops Jais did not give him the opportunity of further explanations. He seemed even to have entirely forgotten his presence in the retod, though no doubt he had given instructions about him, for the two disciples continued to feed him well in the very same place. Next, the fire was always put at his disposal. Days and weeks went and Karma grew impatient. The kitchen, however comfortable it was, now seemed to him a prison. He wanted to work, to go out, to fetch water or fuel, but the Lama's disciples did not allow him to leave the hermitage. The Lama's orders were positive. He had to eat and warm himself. That was all his duty. Karma felt more and more ashamed of being treated like a pet animal that is not expected to do anything in return for its food. At the beginning of his stay, he had repeatedly asked his companions to remind the Lama that he expected an audience, but the latter had always declined to take any message, saying that they would not dare to trouble their Lama, and that when Rinpoche wanted to see him he would send for him. After a time, Karma gave up asking useless questions. His only comfort was to watch for the Lama's appearance on a small balcony where he sometimes sat, or to listen when at long intervals he explained a philosophical treatise to his disciples or to an occasional visitor. Beside these rare gleams, the empty hours dragged on while he revolved the various circumstances which had led him where he was again and again, in his mind. A little more than 1 year passed in this way. Karma became a prey to despair. He would gladly have borne the most cruel ordeals the Lama could have had devised, but this complete forgetfulness amazed him. Though during his first and only interview with the hermit, he had carefully avoided telling him anything regarding his low birth, he now suspected that the latter, through his supernormal powers, had discovered it. Thus, he explained the way in which he had been treated. Probably the master despised him, did not consider him worthy to be taught, and fed him only out of pity. Every day this idea took firmer footing in his mind, and cruelly tortured the proud Karma. Still convinced that a miracle had brought him to Lama Tobsgyi's and that no other guru existed for him in the world, he did not think of undertaking a new journey to find another master, but the thought of committing suicide sometimes came into his mind. Tibetans believe that in order to progress on the mystic path, one must meet one's true Tsorwai Lama, that is to say the spiritual teacher of whom one has already been the disciple during previous lives, or if this cannot be contrived, the Lama of whom one has been the loving relative, supporter or faithful servant. The tie formed in that way is that of the past deeds. Karma was sinking in despondency when a nephew of the anchorite arrived at the retod. The visitor was a Lama Talku, head of a monastery and travelled with a large retinue. Clad in shining robes of yellow brocade, wearing a gilt glittering hat shaped like a pagoda, the Lama and his attendants stopped in the plain at the foot of the hermitage. Beautiful tents were pitched, and after having refreshed himself with tea that the hermit had sent in an enormous silver teapot, the Talku went up to his uncle's dwelling. During the following days, the Talku noticed the strange figure of Karma with his ragged sheepskin robe and his hair which reached to the floor. He asked him why he was always seated next the fire, doing nothing. The aspirant magician took time by the forelock. He had at last found favor with the deities. There could be no doubt that they had aroused this interest in the Talku's mind. He introduced himself with all his titles, told about his long retreat naked in the forest, the conjuration and the kayaka in the gorge, the flood, the rays of light which, springing from the hermitage, rested on his head. He ended by relating the forgetfulness of Kushog Topsgyi's and entreating the Talku to plead on his behalf. From the account which I have heard, it appears probable that the Lama to whom Karma now told his story was of the same stamp as his uncle. He does not appear to have been in the least moved by pity and merely inquired about the kind of teaching which his interlocutor craved from the hermit. The question gladdened Karma. Now he had found somebody who would speak to him about the matter he had so much at heart. He boldly declared that he wished to acquire magic powers, such as that of flying in the air, of causing the earth to quake. But he prudently avoided confessing why he wanted to work wonders. The Talku, Karma realized later on, was only amused by such childish ambitions, but he promised to convey his request to Kushog Topsgyi's. Then during the 2 weeks of his visit he did not even look in the young man's direction again. The day came when the Talku took leave of his uncle. Karma looked sadly at the trooper's attendants at the foot of the hill, who were holding by the bridle the richly caparisoned horses ready to start. The man whom he had considered as a heaven-sent protector was to depart without having obtained any answer to his request. Most likely Kushong Top's Jais had not granted it. Despair again overwhelmed him. The Tulku passed the hermitage's door and Karma was about to salute him with the usual triple bowing down, when the latter gave him this laconic order, "Follow me." Karma Dorji felt rather astonished. He had never been asked to do any service. What could the Lama want?